Representative Carrick in person. Online, we have Representative Ruffridge, Vice Chair Ruffridge, as well as Representative Crox, who's joined us on the phone, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff that will be assisting us today are Kevin Allen with House Records, Romo Marisigan, sorry if I butchered your name, and Johan Timmers with the LIO, and Clark Bickford, staff and committee aide to House Labor and Commerce, is online with us. Thank you for joining us today for an interim committee meeting. We have one item on the agenda, which is HB 119, Cannabis Tax, a bill by request of House Rules. Today we have invited testimony from Cody Rice, staff to the House Majority, and representatives of the AMIA. We also have Director Dompling of the Department of Health available online to answer any questions that members might have for her. We've heard this bill during session in April, and we brought it back today to continue discussion. In April, Cody Rice, staff for the House Majority, shared some economic data related to the bill. There were many questions for Cody at the time of the last meeting. I'm going to invite him to come forward now, himself on the record, and please begin your testimony.
Cody Rice, staff to the House Majority. I have some slides to walk through today, but please feel free to stop anytime. I also have the Excel to back this up if it wants to do any live analysis on it. So many of these slides will be familiar to folks from last session. My background, just to set the context a little bit, I haven't been given any direction on what to present here. I'm trying to stick to the facts, as the House Majority has a variety of views on policy. So a number of states have marijuana taxes and have for several years. The majority are price-based. Alaska has a excise tax that ranges from $50 for the highest category of cannabis to $15 for the lowest category of cannabis leaf. This tax proposes to change that to a $12.50 per ounce tax across all categories, and then to phase in a retail sales tax 18 months after passage. Here, presented this last time, a little bit of an overview of where Alaska ranks both in terms of per capita the tax revenue, right near the middle of the pack, and what the distribution looks like in terms of types of tax systems for cannabis across the U.S. and the jurisdictions. And again, I'm moving pretty quick here in the interest of time, and because we've presented some of these slides before, feel free to jump in if there are questions at any point. A number of independent sources have looked at comparing the tax on cannabis across jurisdictions, and it's a complicated thing to do because of the differences in the taxing methods, but at least this and a couple of others that I saw suggested that the tax in Alaska is higher than it is in almost every other legal jurisdiction, and we can talk about some exceptions or questions if you have questions around that, but the Brookings Institute here indicates that of their survey, Alaska has highest effective tax rate of the other legal jurisdictions. Another key point that I wanted to get across to the committee is that this is a commodity price. This is a commodity. Cannabis is a commodity that post-legalization, what we've seen is a strong downward trend in price. Once you make it legal, the price tends to trend down pretty substantially. And this is data that I pulled from Colorado's Department of Revenue. You can see here, the gray dotted line is our tax rate for bud. The equivalent tax rate we have for bud is $800 per pound. That is and has been in excess of what the retail, or in this case, I think it's a wholesale price in Colorado. But the point being, that's an important distinction to understand in light of potential federal legalization. I know that's outside the scope of the bill, but it's important to understand how Alaska compares to other regions. In an instance where interstate commerce of Alaska would be wildly uncompetitive compared to Oregon, Colorado, other states where the price is much lower. This gets to the crux of the economic analysis, and I'm going to spend a little more time on this chart. But basically, what we have here is Department of Revenue's historical data on how many ounces are sold by category. And again, that highest category is the green line that ends up in the middle. That's Bud at $50 per ounce. And what you can see is post-2021, we've seen a real rollover in the quantity of Bud that's being sold. Well, the lower categories, trim and seedier and mature, have continued the upward trend. What this shows, and what I described it to the committee as previously, is it's a change in the product mix, and it's, in my opinion, a rational response to the tax policy. And what that means is it's very difficult to objectively determine, measure, and test what is or is not CB immature versus bud versus trim. And that's defined in regulation, from my recollection, but it's difficult to enforce. And it gives growers an incentive to find fault in their own product, right? If you have a substantial tax incentive to have it identified in one way versus another. I'm not going to weigh in on what the policy should be, but these are the effects of the policy, and I'm quite confident that that trend is going to continue down for Bud, and that has implications for the state in terms of revenue and in terms of expectations of revenue. So there's been a lot of discussion about revenue neutral and what that looks like. And what I can tell you with a high degree of confidence is that the tax revenues this year from marijuana will be lower than the tax revenues last year from marijuana because of this change in product mix. In fact, looking at the most recent data from Department of Revenue, in order to hit last year's marijuana tax revenue numbers, we would have to see the remainder of the fiscal year revenues exceed the maximum monthly revenue that we have ever received in Alaska by 6% every single month through the rest of the year. That's highly unlikely in my opinion. So I have a high degree of confidence in telling you that tax revenue from marijuana this year would be less than last year. And it's being driven from what I can see by changing the product mix, and that's something that's within the legislature's purview to address. You can see that effect here. Since the beginning of legalization, you can see that the weighted average tax per ounce has declined in every year. And my forecast expects that trend to continue until it levels off at about $19 per ounce on a weighted average basis across all categories. This is the forecast that I have for the current law. So you can see a decline and then an increase as we move into a retail tax situation. And you can compare it to the status quo here. So I have an Excel model that is available to any of the committee members. I've shared it publicly. It's attached in the previous committee hearing documents. And what I did was I created a couple of scenarios. So I took two scenarios for market size from the AMIA, low scenario, which we're showing here, low growth, and then a high growth scenario. And then as well, I did my own independent scenario, and I did a 7.5% per year growth rate. And in every single one of those scenarios, a $12.50 per ounce for 18 months, followed by a 10% retail sales tax, the revenues actually exceed the expected revenues under the status quo. So what you see is the revenue drops very quickly under the proposed legislation for House Bill 19 because you're dropping the tax rate from an effective tax rate of about $28 per ounce last year to $12.50 for 18 months before kicking into the 10% retail sales tax. One of the things I wanted to mention while we're on this topic, there were questions from the committee last time about what the tax reduction looked like. And nominally, we're talking about going from $50 at the top rate to 1250. But that's not really an accurate comparison because the 50 is just the top category, which we showed is rolling over. So if you look at weighted average tax per ounce, was about $28 last year. I'm forecasting it's going to be about $26 this year. And so that is the tax change you're really talking about, the magnitude you're really talking about. It's about a 50% reduction, not 75. And then if you think about it in terms of a retail sales tax, what would the equivalent be? There's a little bit of fuzziness because it requires you to estimate the entire market size. So I took revenue data, marijuana revenue data from 14 jurisdictions across Alaska, from Billingham, Mattsu, Anchorage, Juneau, et cetera, gross those up. That covers about 88% of the population. So grossing up from there, I feel simply confident that I've got a rough estimate of market size. And what that implied is that the current sales tax equivalent would be around 11 to 12%. So you're talking about a 1 to 2% reduction in effective tax, 10% change, with a change to a 10% sales tax. So I thought it was important to mention those things.
Thank you, Mr. Price. And let the record reflect that Representative Sadler has joined us at 3:12 p.m. Please proceed.
That's essentially all I had. I just want to summarize quickly and say the facts that I can share with the committee are that legal marijuana prices tend to drop over time. Alaska has, by numerous measures, higher than average taxes. The product mix, as we know, is changing now, and that's resulting in lower revenue. And if nothing's done, my estimate suggests the revenue will be around $9 million a year less in 3 years. And the total effect of this legislation under every single one of the four scenarios that I modeled growth-wise is higher tax revenues in aggregate through 2030 than sticking to the status quo as it is now. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Rice. Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Rice, so looking back at the third slide, the marijuana taxes by type, and one more slide, actually, fourth slide. So if this legislation were to pass, can you comment on where Alaska would be comparative to other states in terms of total tax burden?
It would reduce it, but as I was saying before, if you, it depends on where in time, right? So if we look at this chart, for the immediate 18 months, the reduction in effective tax rate from essentially $28 last year, weighted average tax per ounce, to $12.50 is a substantial reduction. My estimate was that this year, weighted average tax per ounce would be about 26. So you're talking about a 50% reduction in the near term, and then you're talking about actually, at least from my calculations, a 1 to 2% reduction in retail sales tax, or the effective retail sales tax, since we don't have one now.
Yeah. Mr. Rice, what percentage retail sales tax do you think would put us about in the middle of that pack for states as far as tax rate?
Chair Sumner, that's a good question. Off the top of my head, I believe that the average for states that have a retail sales tax is around 7 to 12-ish percent. Some have taxes as high as 37% in Washington, but they have much lower cost inputs, I guess you could say. So the proposed rates are certainly in the realm of the reasonable in terms of distribution-wise. But I don't know off the top of my head exactly what the average was.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Rice? Anybody online?
This is Representative Prompt. Can you hear me?
Go ahead, Representative Prompt.
Yes, I'm just trying to understand the analysis, because the fiscal note from the Department of Revenue appears to come up with a different conclusion that we would reduce current income by $18 million in the first full year, and then a further decrease of $27.6 million in 2029. If we had a 3% sales tax and $12.50 per ounce wholesale transfer tax. If I understand your model, the conclusion is much more optimistic as far as revenue is concerned. Is that because you took the weighted average and they didn't, or can you explain the difference between the conclusion the Department of Revenue came up with and your conclusion?
Mr. Rice, if you'd like to take that.
Through the chair, Representative Cross, I can't speak to the details of the Department of Revenue modeling, but what I can say is from my recollection, they looked at holding last year's tax essentially constant or inflating it, and that's simply not accurate. There will, with a very high degree of confidence, be less tax revenue this year than last year, and I expect that trend to continue down. And so that's important to understand in terms of a baseline, right? If you're assuming that the tax rate stays at $28, $29 million a year, then the change, the delta for this reduction is larger. If you expect, as I do, that the tax revenues are declining without any changes, then the tax revenues look lower. And I think the other point that I would make is that these models are assuming a 10% retail tax at this point. If you ran it at 3%, which I can absolutely do for you or your staff, I think the numbers might look quite different.
Okay.
Representative Kerr.
Another question is, you had talked a little bit about the reduction in revenue over the next year going forward based on the product mix. But can you comment to you about the current, and this might be a better question for the industry folks, but in your estimation, what component or what role does just overburden on the cultivation side play in a reduction in overall revenue? Like, are we losing cultivators in the state, and that's causing a reduction in revenue as well going forward?
My understanding is that we are, yeah. I'm sure the industry can speak to that with more detail than quantify it in terms of licenses that aren't new, that sort of thing.
Are there any other questions online for Mr. Rice? Okay, seeing no other questions from Mr. Price, thank you for being here today. I would now like to ask Brandon Emmett of the AMIA board to come forward, put your name on the record, and begin your invited testimony.
Thank you, Chair Sumner, members of the committee. My name is Brandon Emmett. I'm from Fairbanks, Alaska, and I am actually representing the governor's tax task force here today. So you have before you the recommendations made by the governor's task force. They are in many ways similar to HB 119. One of the key differences is in the recommended percentage of tax from the governor's tax task force versus what is contained in the bill. Governor Dunleavy tasked us with analyzing the industry and finding ways to foster collaboration between the industry and state government, and to also look at the future and viability of the industry. So I'm not here today to speak for the marijuana businesses, only the analysis that we had provided. And so I could answer specific questions about some of our recommendations if you would like. But in a nutshell, given the weight of the burden to produce marijuana in the industry, given the anecdotal evidence that we know to be reasonably true with the strength of the black market and the attrition rate that we have seen recently, in lieu of any other changes going forward, that this committee recommend a drastic reduction in taxes, looking towards the long-term viability of the industry. And then thus our recommendations were built upon those principles.
Thank you, Mr. Emmett. Are there any questions by committee members for Mr. Emmett? Representative Carrick?
Thanks, through the chair. So right now, the CS has the burden at 10%. So can you comment on some of the impacts if at 10% versus at a lower rate? Say, I know the AMIA has talked about a 6% rate or 4% rate. Can you talk about some of the impacts maybe the tax task force has looked at in terms of impacts at those different levels?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick. Yes, so the tax force believes that a change to a 10% tax is essentially sliding the burden from the cultivators who we feel are not the best suited to provide that tax base to the retailers, but doesn't truly provide any relief. Alaska has some of the highest taxes, as you saw from Mr. Rice's presentation, the highest effective tax in the nation. We also have some of the highest cost to produce marijuana, and we are combating a very healthy black market. And so we believe that without any other change anywhere in the industry, that a 10% tax is just not really an effective change. It might be a step in the right direction in switching it from one taxpayer to another, but it doesn't really provide the relief and the ability for long-term sustainability that I believe the task force was tasked with presenting here.
There are any other questions for Mr. Emmett? Anyone online?
Yep, this is Representative Bronx from Fairbank.
Go ahead, Representative Bronx.
Yep, through the chair, does the task force have an estimate of the percentage of sales that is still going through the black market? And I guess the follow-up to that would be, how much did legalization change that percentage?
Through the chair to Representative Brox. That's a good question. So when marijuana was legalized in the state of Alaska, there were a couple different pollsters who went and just called around and asked people how much cannabis they consume and what sort of demographic of people consume that cannabis. And we got pretty close to the number, and you can see from the price and the tax revenue generated. And so we don't have a specific poll to lean upon, but anecdotal evidence suggests that full 40 to 50% of the marijuana being sold in Alaska's market is black market marijuana, and that is price driven. Again, I don't have a statistic to lean on, but any consumer can go to a bar in Fairbanks and find marijuana that is 50% of the price that it is in the retail store. And so I would love to see a study done by someone like MPP to really go and poll people and see exactly where they're getting their marijuana and what price they're paying for it. But I can tell you with a high degree of certainty that it is still much cheaper on the black market, and that Alaska's taxes and the burden on businesses from the Marijuana Control Board is causing those prices to stay high and keeping Alaska's businesses uncompetitive versus that black market.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions for Mr. Emmett?
Yes, this is Representative Brox again.
Representative Brox.
Yes, through the chair, the task force made several other recommendations that they felt would make it easier for marijuana businesses to operate. removing, removing the product transfer restrictions was one, annual registration was another, and the third was amend transportation regulations. And those, of course, from the task force narrative seem to make sense. Should we be just focusing on the immediate, or should we be including those other recommendations at this time?
Through the chair, Representative Prox. So I myself have a public safety background. I was a paramedic for a long time. I also served on the Marijuana Control Board. And one of the things that I felt important that we analyze is, do recommendations address public health and safety? And if they do, they're probably in the public interest. If they do not, are they overly burdensome? And so many of these recommendations, not specifically pertaining to tax, but pertaining to the way marijuana is regulated, were done through the scope of a concern for public health and safety. Does it make Alaska any safer for marijuana businesses to simply pay double for their registrations when they're already paying the highest tax rate in the nation? No. Does it make Alaskans any safer to prohibit them from participating in commerce however they see fit? No. And so we felt it prudent to make recommendations that allow the industry to flourish and to have the best chance of survival possible while keeping public health and safety in mind.
And Representative Prox, we will be entertaining amendments to the CS at a future meeting, so I anticipate there will be some, and perhaps from you as well. Are there any other questions for Mr. Emden? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Emmett.
Thank you, Chair Sommer.
And are there any questions for Director Gompling of the Department of Health who we have online? Okay. Oh, I see no other questions. Oh.
Chair Sommer, this is yes. Mike again from Fairbank.
Representative Prox, go ahead.
Okay. I was reading some of the statistics from Department of Health, and then there was another nationwide study. And roughly, the assumption is that, well, any use of marijuana has a public health concern. But within the national report, the survey indicated that quite a number of people are taking marijuana self-medicating for some problem that they were experiencing, depression or sleeplessness or whatever. But is there any data that suggests there is, in fact, a benefit, as well as if you use anything too much, there's a problem? I understand that. But are there any documented benefits?
I guess Director Dompling, if you heard the question, you can proceed to answer.
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair, to Representative Prax. I just got a text too that I could defer to Eliza News. She's actually, or Christy Lawton, I believe Christy's there in the room. They're with the Department, or excuse me, the Division of Public Health that might be able to better answer that question.
Okay. Do we have anybody from the Division of Public Health? Room. Please approach, put your name on the record, and if you could answer Representative Prox's question, it would be appreciated. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Christy Botten. I'm Deputy Director of the Division of Public Health at the Department of Health. I was prepared to give some basic comments about impact of that bill, but I would defer to Eliza Muse, who is our subject matter expert, who should be on the call and can answer that specific question.
Hi, this is Eliza Muse for the record with the Division of Public Health. Through the chair to Representative Prox, there are certainly conditions for which cannabis has been recognized as efficacious. And even prior to Alaska's legalization of a marketplace, we had a medical marijuana registry and a card program, which was actually run through the Department of Health, which is still run through the Department of Health. While we're seeing the need for cards dropping over time, those numbers are going down because of perhaps the legal marketplace, there certainly is a time and place for medical marijuana. And we do have a list of debilitating conditions for which medical marijuana or a card would be recommended in our state. And I think the survey that Representative Prox is referring to is the International Cannabis Policy Study, which is a very comprehensive study that looks at use trends over time, the reasons for use. There's actually a section in there that does talk about where Alaskans purchase products, whether it be through a retailer, through their dealer, through the illicit marketplace. So it's a wealth of information, so I really appreciate that you've taken a look at that report. And I have prior years reports as well that we are happy to share.
Thank you, Mrs. Muse. Are there any other questions from the committee for Mrs. Muse or Mrs. Lott? Okay, seeing none, Mrs. Lott, did you say you had a presentation that you wanted to make?
Chair, not a presentation, just a few remarks in regards to the impact regarding the committee substitute, if you would like.
Go ahead, Mrs. Lott.
Again, for the record, Christy Lawton. As you already know, HB 119 seeks to address the current fiscal challenges to the cannabis industry by proposing how marijuana is taxed. This HB 119, the committee substitute, does have tax revenue support that provides prevention, education, and treatment funds, and this legislation that would remain intact. However, and this works specifically for the Division of Public Health, would ensure long-term critical after-school programming around the state designed to build protective factors related to reducing substance misuse among youth in grades 5 through 8. Could continue. While this version would result in a temporary reduction in funds until the proposed sales tax becomes effective, we would anticipate that the funds would be fully restored based on projections by the Department of Revenue. So the bill maintains the cannabis taxes collected under AS 4361010, which supports not only the Marijuana Education Treatment Fund, but also the Recidivism Reduction Fund, General, and Treatment. The Department of Health in this bill may use up to 50% of that fund, which would be up from 25% of the annual estimated balance for the fund, to make appropriations which are currently focused on grant programs around marijuana misuse. If version B pass, the Division of Public Health would need to pause outgoing grants that are in place right now for the actual programs currently funded, as well as some other professional services contracts, again, until that 10% retail sales tax was implemented and the fund stabilizes, likely through June 30 of 2025. So this version, if enacted, again, what would temporarily impact services intended to counteract the negative health, safety, and societal consequences associated with legalization. It is likely that some of the current office statewide programs would be ended or reduced, resulting in less youth served. However, the version overall in the long term would increase the funds, which would expand services to youth and help these programs continue to grow.
Thank you, Mrs. Lott. Are there any questions? Representative Chair.
Thanks, through the chair. You said some programs would have to temporarily pause. And are there any programs that are currently fully dependent on funding and from recidivism reduction funds, or sorry, not recidivism reduction, but marijuana tax funds? Or are there other funding sources for some of those programs you said may temporarily cease?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Carrick. So we have, in the Division of Public Health, we've got 10 grantees that are providing these after-school programs and the activities and services. And of those, we have three that are pretty much exclusively funded with the grants from these programs. That's a program that is operating out of serving communities of Kokona, Volcanic, Glen Allen. We've also got Youth Advocates of Sitka, so that program would be significantly impacted, as well as one in Keanu.
And just a follow-up, is there an estimation for assuming all the trends we've discussed hold with passage of this legislation, an estimation for how long those temporary pauses would last, looking at maybe a year or 2 years? What's a potential reasonable estimation for how long that funding would be paused?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, I think the previous testimony that in terms of the 18 months roughly to get the tax, sales tax implemented, that would be when we would continue to receive the revenue that could reinstitute and get those grants back out into the communities. But we would have funding, you know, when this bill becomes effective based on the changes that would become effective immediately. We would need to wait until the sales tax comes in to put grants back into place.
Okay. Are there any other questions from committee members online for Mrs. Lott?
Yes, this is Representative Prox calling again from Pyrrhic.
Go ahead, Representative Prox.
Yes, through the chair, several decades ago, I was involved with when I was in high school, I was involved with a service organization that developed and presented a education program intended to discourage drug use. And that was presented mostly in junior high level schools. We got an award for it. But after a couple of years, we kind of all concluded that it might even have been counterproductive. That isn't a real scientific analysis. But my question is, do you have any sort of surveys or measurements to determine the efficacy of the Department of Prevention efforts?
Chair Sumner, I'd like to defer that question to Eliza Muse, if I may.
Okay. Mrs. Muse, if you're still online and you heard the question, you can go ahead and answer Representative Prox.
For the record, this is Eliza Muse with the Division of Public Health, Department of Health. I think we've learned a lot in the last several decades about those early prevention campaigns. You know, I think we think of the DARE programs, and we did learn that those were counterproductive in our efforts to reduce substance misuse. This model that we're employing now is based in an Icelandic prevention model, which really looks at a variety of risk and protective factors to reduce substance misuse. It's updated, and how we measure the success of our program right now, this grant program has been active for 4 years. We're in our fifth year with a whole new set of grantees, and it's really around providing a safe and nurturing space for youth to engage with their peers and other trusted adults that they might have questions about cannabis use. We use a real fact-based approach to talking about it, and really try not to use fear tactics or any other sorts of fear mongering, just really giving kids the facts about cannabis use. And we talk about cannabis use directly, but also the purpose of after school programs are to be a safe place for kids to gather outside of school time. It's not a marijuana prevention after school program. It's really intended to be a safe place for kids to gather. And then also a piece of this is around quality. We know that structured quality programs with staff who are trained are going to do the best job in conveying this information to you. Another, the target or the priority population for these grants are for youth in grades 5 through 8. And that was really intentional because that's where we see cannabis use experimentation start. 1 in 10 youth start around the age of 13. And we also know that preventing use or delaying onset of use at that age, during that age time, is really important because the earlier and the more progressive use can lead to addiction later on in adulthood. So how we're measuring it right now is we aren't necessarily asking youth about their cannabis use. What we're doing to measure success of this program is through implementation metrics. So are we expanding programming? Are we expanding the hours through which these programs serve youth? Are we providing quality assessments and training to staff? So sort of those foundational principles of a program around quality first before talking to youth and measuring actual youth patterns. We'll do that at a population level. We'll take youth risk behavior survey data to look at change over time, which are associated with some of the programming, but not specific to this program.
Okay, thank you. But my interest, because I just, from the statistics and whatnot that were in the Marijuana Control Board's report, and even that national report, I think, it seemed to me that marijuana use amongst high school age kids was still pretty high. I didn't see, I guess I didn't see that it changed much. It changed a little bit, but it didn't seem to be changing much with legalization. It went up, I think, a little bit. But do you have some data that could give us an idea of, rather than implementation, the results? The end result is the amount of usage either went down or it's not trending up as fast as it was or something like that. Is there any data available to make an assessment of that?
Through the chair, this is Eliza Muse, for the record, with the Division of Public Health. We have Alaska Youth Risk Behavior Survey data from 2019. That data is, we were unable to implement the survey in 2021. But what we've seen over time, so we've got a trend line that is stable for use of cannabis products pre and post legalization. We haven't seen any upward trend or downward trend for all high schoolers. When you start to disaggregate by gender and grade, we do see a small uptick among female youth. So at a population level, we certainly have data. It's slightly outdated. We will have 2023 survey data, hopefully in the spring, and be able to utilize that data to help understand how we're doing in terms of youth cannabis use here in Alaska.
Okay, follow up.
Go ahead.
So you would say that the data has been collected over a sufficient amount of time to be meaningful for a trend? Is that true?
I'm sorry. The question was, this is Eliza Muse for the record, that the data is meaningful to our program.
Yes, the question, I guess, is have you been collecting this data for a sufficient amount of time that we can determine some reasonable trend?
Representative Prock, absolutely. These data are very reliable for our program, and we use them for program evaluation. And it's great to see that cannabis use has remained stable. When you do map out cannabis alongside other substances such as tobacco or alcohol, it does paint a different story because what we've seen over long-term trends for alcohol as well as tobacco, not talking about vaping, but other substances, that there is a downward trend among those substances. So maybe being the fact that we're stable is not as great as we think it might be. But it's certainly an area for continued focus and research.
Right. Follow up?
Go ahead.
So is it fair to say then that there hasn't been as significant an increase as one might have expected, that the programs are successful. Is that kind of what you're concluding?
This is Eliza Muse, for the record, with the Division of Public Health. Our after-school program and grants really served a very small proportion of the population when you're looking at all youth who might be participating in the Alaska Risk Behavior Survey. But what we're seeing in terms of trends is at the population level as a whole across all the legal states is that cannabis use has remained stable across states such as Oregon, Washington, Colorado, has remained stable. And many of these other states have also implemented similar youth prevention work utilizing funding from cannabis excise taxes or cannabis tax taxes. So we're all kind of doing the same thing. We're seeing flat, stable youth patterns over time. I think there's a lot of the combination of factors too, and not just a singular grant program, but I certainly think you know, more research is needed.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Muse and Mrs. Watson. Thank you. We also have Lacey Wilcox with the AMIA here for testimony. Mrs. Wilcox, why don't you approach and put your name on the record?
Hi, Lacey Wilcox, echoey, legislative liaison for the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association, board members. So everything was pretty well covered. Emmett did a pretty good job of laying out industry concerns from a task force perspective. The AMIA supports those recommendations as submitted to the legislature and the governor. I'm available for questions that are specific to the impact to industry, specifically job loss, a status quo, just overall economic impact, what we're seeing now with attrition, tax delinquency, the overburdensome regulations, kind of what we face on a day-to-day, the reality of it. And when we start to speak as an industry and peers and competitors who are fierce, we're all in survival mode. And we are coming together to share the pain with you now, and it was not a surprise. So 5-6 years ago, we knew we were going to need to come to you to have the taxes changed. We knew that at the ballot measure moment, but it was done so in the way that it was for simplicity, for the Department of Revenue, and for the voters to understand what they were going to potentially see as a forecast. A complex tax scheme wasn't something that we could really conceptualize. We didn't have data to support market size, and we really couldn't forecast with accuracy to the satisfaction of the finance committees and the legislature at the time. So we are here as expected, even a little bit later than we expected to ask for these changes. And we do support the 3% findings of the task force. The current CS at 10% is going to continue to be an overburdensome tax number in the effective tax rate, especially considering there is not language currently that puts a overall effective cap when you combine municipal taxes. So for example, in Bethel, you've got a 15% marijuana tax, an additional 6% sales tax. That gets you to a 21% effective tax rate at 10%. You can see where I'm going with this. That might be very different in Anchorage, different in Juneau, but if we're not being really careful, we are really just shifting the burden, and reasonably with Cody Rice's model, you could see at 10% that the burden in fact becomes larger over time. I'm just really here for questions. Everything was well covered. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mrs. Wilcox. Are there any questions? Representative Kerr.
Thanks. Through the chair, Lacey, can you talk a little bit about the attrition that the industry has seen on the cultivation side with the tax rate where it is currently? And is that something that's been regional and potentially due to other economic factors? Or can you comment on, in your opinion, how much that is due to some of these tax burdens and regulation concerns?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things to remember. When we legalized and created the framework and statute for license types, we created two cultivation license types. One is a limited and one is a standard grow. That's really just a canopy size and output size. And the reasons why we did that was to capture black market or gray market home grows and to kind of incentivize them to come into the legal framework. And what we saw in the beginning was a tremendous amount, tremendous is a big word, but a healthy amount of existing home grows prior to legalization sign up to become taxpayers. Their tax burden at a limited small grow, which could happen in their residence, in their basement of their home, alongside all the regulations that a large grow and a commercial grow that you would more typically imagine, a big warehouse or an indoor greenhouse, same tax burden, same taxpayer, same taxable moment. The attrition on the small grow side is something that I could probably compute to over 30%. That's going to be due to the multi-issue of overburdensome regulations, intrusion into your personal residence through cameras, tracking, premises, protests, your neighbors don't like you. There's a lot of other factors on the small grows and the reduction in the number we see there. Standard cultivations or more commercial large grows, I think we're seeing about a 25% decline in renewals. There are other factors at play. It is really important to remember that when a business in cannabis cultivation stops operating and doesn't renew, currently there is very little that can be done to recoup the delinquent taxes that that business owes at the end of their business. So we do see a 25 or so large grows not renewing just from last year to now. That's about a 25% loss in cultivation. That's a 25% loss at taxpayer. Each one of these yields a different volume of money to the state, so it will be in your next annual report from the tax division to see what that impact is realistically. I think Cody Rice did a pretty good job of taking that into account in this model. We've already seen a failure in the small capture of small grows, which was really intended to capture the market share from the black market. Reasonably, I get asked if lowering the tax, lowering the price is going to increase consumption. I'm not super magic to know that, but I could say that the consumer rate is the consumer rate. Where they shop is what we would like to capture. And as we lose small grows for this and other reasons, primarily this reason, the consumer isn't going to find the product on the black market at 50% of the price. And I think it would be fair for you guys to understand that when they do not renew their license, they're reasonably going to continue to operate illicitly. That's a pretty confident assumption of the industry. They are not necessarily going to shut down. They're just going to not renew their license and not pay taxes. They become the black market again.
Go ahead, Representative Kerr.
Through the chair, so just to summarize, the industry is not seeing a drop-off in demand.
Right.
We're seeing a regulatory and a tax burden that's causing a drop-off in supply.
Correct.
And to summarize what you're saying there.
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Kerr, Cody Rice had explained the product mixing, which is the ability to declare your taxable commodity at a different value. And it's up to me, the cultivator, to disclose the value of the product that I've transferred, therefore determining the taxable amount due. It's an honor system. And so it's another way to say it is the industry is incentivized to cheat. And I don't like to put those kinds of words out there into the world, except in this case, because I'm here to protect an industry that is incentivized without enforcement to cheat because of something that is not sustainable. This is a very desperate situation that we're in. Yes.
Question. Go ahead.
Thank you, through the chair. And can you also comment? I know the industry has an ideal tax rate, 3%, has been tossed around. But can you talk a little bit about what sort of that maximum could be on the industry while still trying to prevent some of that black market push-off that we're currently seeing? In other words, is there a number between the current 10% and the 3% that is sustainable to the industry but not increasing, in your opinion, that demand outside the legal industry?
No, the number is 3, and that's something I've given a lot of thought myself as a cultivator and as a board and a trade group, we started our line of thinking at 0%. We are faced with such other obstacles that 3% still feels like a tax. Certainly, this is a negotiation. I look forward to a finance committee moment where we can really talk about how to play with that model and find that balance. But we have to think long term, and I think that's why we are holding firm at 3%. You all are the policymakers, and we will respect your decision here. If we can all at least agree that the current tax rate, which at 10% would be status quo, is punitive to the industry. And so anything under 10% is less punitive. 3% is economically going to see your industry flourish and grow. You're going to see innovative new products that you've never seen. You're going to be able to capture the value add at retail based on the consumer's perspective of the worth of what they're buying. So you potentially, beyond Cody Rice's model, will see more revenue based on the value perceived by the consumer, where you do not capture that now.
Are there any questions from committee members online for Mrs. Wilcox?
I have one.
Representative Ruffridge, go ahead.
Thank you. I was just wondering if you could just detail for me quickly what the different tax sort of structures are currently, sort of maybe elucidating that cheating model a little bit more. And I think I have an idea of what it is. So bud would be taxed at a different rate than trim, other sorts of things. Is that something you could just speak to briefly for me?
Sure. I think when we all began, we were certainly honest brokers for fear of enforcement through the chair. Apologies. People were doing their very best to be very honest, fearful of enforcement, fearful of all types of consequence. Seeing a lack of enforcement, seeing the price drop, what you are able to do as the declarer of the value is perhaps harvest your product, determine that it is not of highest value, it is immature, or it isn't going to yield the market price at that $50 an ounce level. So you can come up with a formula inside your cultivation that seems honest enough. And so cheating is a hard word to use, but you're guessing. If I transfer a pound of not high quality product and I'm allowed to say to the tax man it's not the highest quality and he believes me and there's nothing he can do to enforce or to know better, why would a cultivator not do that? And truth be told, it's really hard to do this officially, but I would say confidently that 90% of cultivators probably have had to do this at this point when you have a decision to make between making payroll, keeping the lights on, and coming up with a percentage that's roughly close to high quality, low quality out of one harvest. I hope that answers the question. It's a little tricky not to put anybody on the spotlight.
That was helpful. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mrs. Wilcox. Seeing no other questions, that will conclude our meeting on cannabis tax and House Labor and Commerce. Our staff will reach out to committee members to discuss their availability in October or November to see about a potential hearing to address amendments to this bill. That concludes our business today. Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 4 p.m. We stand in recess.